What's your purpose? Your why? Because at PNC Private Bank, we want to help you achieve it. We'll take care of the how, so just tell us, what's your why? To learn more, please visit pnc.com/private bank. Copyright 2022, the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
This is your tech news briefing for Tuesday, October 25th. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. For companies that make semiconductors, the past few years have brought plenty of challenges. A chip shortage and now a chip glut. And throughout it all, geopolitical challenges. That's got the Biden administration encouraging chip makers to build more of them here in the U.S. But will that be enough to help U.S. chip companies overcome a possible recession and steep competition from overseas? At the Wall Street Journal's Tech Live conference yesterday, Intel CEO Patrick Gelsinger sat down with WSJ editor Thorold Barker to talk about these issues and more. We'll have highlights from their conversation after these headlines. Two Chinese intelligence officers are facing charges for trying to bribe a U.S. law enforcement official. The pair were allegedly trying to obtain inside information about the U.S. criminal case against Chinese telecoms giant Huawei. That's according to prosecutors in the case that was unsealed yesterday. Attorney General Merrick Garland detailed the charges in a press conference.
The government of China sought to interfere with the rights and freedoms of individuals in the United States and to undermine our judicial system that protects those rights. They did not succeed. The Justice Department will not tolerate attempts by any foreign power to undermine the rule of law upon which our democracy is based.
The case refers to an unnamed company, but people familiar with the case say it concerns Huawei. For years, the U.S. has warned that the Chinese government could use Huawei's gear for spying. The Chinese embassy in Washington and a spokesman for Huawei didn't respond to requests for comment. Both Beijing and Huawei have repeatedly denied earlier allegations of wrongdoing. We report exclusively that telehealth startup Cerebral says it'll be laying off a fifth of its workforce. The company says it's shrinking operations to match patient demand and lower growth targets. In a memo to staff on Monday, Cerebral's CEO said the changes would be spread across all divisions, from headquarters to clinical care teams. Cerebral launched its services in 2020. It added hundreds of thousands of patients relying on ads on social media and quick prescriptions for ADHD medications like Adderall. Some of its practices are being investigated by the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department. The company has said it's cooperating with these investigations and that it's stopped prescribing most controlled substances to new patients. And you never know who you'll bump into running around the WSJ's Tech Live event, or which outspoken founders you'll be able to snag 5 minutes with. Palmer Luckey founded Oculus in his 20s, before going on to sell it to Facebook. He then went on to found Anduril Industries, which creates defense technologies for military agencies. I ran into him in the Tech Live green room. Palmer Luckey, thanks for talking to Tech News Briefing.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we expect to hear quite a lot about the metaverse at Tech Live. As such a supporter of the metaverse, but somebody who's working in defense, where do you see that technology fitting into the metaverse as it develops?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I mean, one of the issues with the metaverse right now is everyone's trying to make everything metaverse, right? You've got the metaverse of grocery shopping. You've got the metaverse of trading cards. And so you're seeing a lot of people doing this with defense and be like, what's the metaverse for defense? I think that's kind of the hypey way to look at it. The reality is the military has been funding research in virtual reality back when there was no consumer virtual reality industry. I mean, when I talk to my buddies in the defense space working on VR, most of them say, you know, there are things that VR is useful for, whether it's command and control or visualization or having people across multiple platforms, you know, one person on a destroyer, one on an aircraft, one back in Washington, D.C., to all sit around the same table virtually and, you know, collaborate on something. That's something that our company's making technology for. And, you know, that stuff makes sense, but I'm not sure that there will be a metaverse for defense, or I'm not sure anyone will ever build a thing that quite works out that way. But hey, maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe we're going to have metaverse military bases.
Your company is doing a lot of work in Ukraine right now. Given how the war is progressing, what kind of technology are you thinking about developing based on what you're seeing there?
Well, a lot of the technology that we're developing, these are the things that are relevant to the conflict. And most of the feedback we've been getting, it isn't actually changing what we're developing. It's changing the specifics of the features that we're adding. So we knew things like distributed autonomy, having lots of large swarms of drones that can be easily controlled by large numbers of people. These were applicable before the war. They were applicable during the war, and they were applicable after the war. But we're getting feedback on, for example, how to build user interfaces that are useful for people who have to be doing 100 other tasks at the same time instead of focusing on just one weapons platform. You know, building tools that allow people to easily share data from sensors with other weapon systems using non-traditional internet. So not necessarily using tactical radios, but over cellular links, so over things like Starlink. These are the types of improvements that we're adding to our systems, and that's based on the experiences that my team has had in Ukraine and that myself have had in Ukraine.
Paul Marlucki, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thank you so much for having me.
All right, coming up, is the Federal CHIPS Act enough to help Intel weather a possible recession and geopolitical tensions? The company's CEO was at Tech Live to discuss that and more. We'll have his comments after the break.
This year's been a roller coaster, and not the fun kind. Business know. It's a dangerous time not to know your numbers. That's why you need NetSuite by Oracle. Over 31,000 businesses have the confidence they need. NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing offer. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
The chip industry is in a period of transition. Intel, which reports earnings later this week, has been hit hard by a recent softening of demand for semiconductors. But the company has also had some recent wins, including the passage of the bipartisan CHIPS Act. That'll pour about $52 billion into expanding domestic production of chips. And Intel is betting big on U.S. production, with plans to build foundries in Ohio and Arizona, as Western companies look to break their reliance on Asian supply chains. Intel CEO Patrick Gelsinger kicked off our Tech Live conference yesterday, speaking about this and more with WSJ editor Thorold Barker. Here are highlights from their conversation.
Hello, everybody, and Pat, welcome to Tech Live. Thanks very much for coming to be our first speaker. We've got a lot of ground to cover. So for the last few years, we've read endlessly about the shortage of chips in the world and not being able to get enough for cars and other things. That seems to have now flipped into a different situation where there's an excess of chips and prices have come down and you've had some pretty tough earnings. You've been in the industry a long time. Is this a chip cycle or is this an economic recession that you're looking at?
Well, obviously, chips are super important to the planet, right? You know, it's why we saw the CHIPS Act, why we saw, you know, all this discussion around chips broadly. And, you know, the expectation is by the end of the decade, the chips industry approximately doubles. You know, today about $600 billion, by the end of the decade, $1.1 trillion, right, in that view. So you clearly have a growing industry long-term. So fundamentally, we have a long-term growth cycle in front of us, and we have near-term wild cycles, right? Obviously, you know, the COVID-induced cycle where sort of overnight, right, we saw supply chains disrupted, so supply decreased by 5-ish percent on an industry that typically is growing by 5% per year, 5-6% per year, and demand went to 25% per year. So all of a sudden you see this huge acceleration in demand, right, decrease in supply, disruptions in supply chains, right, and I'll just say the overstimulation of the economies around the world, and clearly that was most accentuated in the semiconductor industry. Well, now we're catching up. Right, you've seen the economy slow down around the world, supply chains for the first time, you know. So it really is one of those cycles, but it's against the backdrop where the industry is going to double this decade. So we have to keep building those long-term factory build-outs, even though we have to make near-term adjustments and price variations, right, and dealing with, you know, Shanghai port shutdowns and so on. It's been a pretty dramatic, a year and a half.
So you've been in Washington a lot, helping to push through the CHIPS Act. How reliant is Intel now on subsidy going forward?
First, let's contextualize the CHIPS Act, right? And we have the U.S. CHIPS Act and the EU CHIPS Act. You know, if we were building manufacturing in Asia, you know, the expectations and SIA estimates say it would be 30 or 40% cheaper if we were building in Asia. Supply chains are now firmly consolidated there. It is simply economically uncompetitive to build in U.S. or Europe. And that's why we saw the industry move from 80-20 in 1990 in U.S. and Europe to 2080 today. You know, it's been a dramatic shift over the last 30 years. So the CHIPS Act was balancing, you know, essentially leveling that playing field.
So your strategy would still have been the same in terms of both the design and the production of chips. You'd have just been doing it somewhere else.
Absolutely. It has to be competitive. When you're making that level of investment, right, got to be competitive.
So a lot of this is about China. Can you talk a little bit about what your view is on the latest rules out of the Biden administration to stop technology transfer, both in terms of the technology itself and the people doing that? What is your take on this? Is this a good thing?
I think it was inevitable, right? You know, and, you know, this view of how something so critical to every industry, every business, and are we going to, you know, be able to continue to have leadership on those technologies? Part of the reason I've been such an advocate for many of these policies, I viewed this geopolitically as inevitable. And that's why the rebalancing of supply chains, you know, is so critical, right? You know, are we going to have the supply chains that we need for our autos, you know, for our AI, for our national security, for our game consoles, for our PCs?
But when you were lobbying for the CHIPS Act, were you also pushing for this?
No.
But you're welcoming of it.
Yeah, I expected this to be the case. You know, it's part of the reason that I've always used the phrase geographically balanced, resilient supply chains. You know, Taiwan plays such a critical role, you know, for the technology supply chains, but it's precarious. Even the Taiwanese vendors believe deeply they need their supply chains to become more balanced. So, you know, I view this very inevitable, right, as we look to the future. And given that, you know, none of the policies that are, you know, being put in place, well, I don't think any of us should be surprised by that.
And just quickly, what is the gap like now between Chinese capability and Western capability?
Yeah, today, you know, the most advanced in China, right, is about 14 nanometers today. You know, different estimates. Today, you know, we're doing 7 nanometers, about to do 4, right? TSMC in Taiwan's about to start their 3 production. And, you know, we're racing to have our sub-2 nanometers by 2025. You know, and the policies that you've seen are basically to maintain or increase that gap between where China is, right, and where U.S. or European capabilities would be.
Great. Thank you very much, Pat.
All right, that's it for today's Tech News Briefing. Tech Live continues tomorrow. For live coverage of the event, visit our website, wsj.com. And journal subscribers can get a complimentary online pass at wsj.com/techlive. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Free Expression, a new podcast from The Wall Street Journal with me, Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of The Wall Street Journal. It's a podcast in which we're going to be trying to do something a little different, dig a little deeper into the issues behind the headlines that are in the news all the time. So please join me for my new podcast, Free Expression, with Jerry Baker at The Wall Street Journal. We're very much looking forward to really having some fascinating conversations, and I very much hope you'll join us.